Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Alejandra Bronfman, one of the hosts of New Books in Caribbean Studies. My guest today is Juanita de Barras, author of Reproducing the British Caribbean, Sex, Gender, and Population Politics After Slavery, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. This wonderfully engaging book considers the issues of health and reproduction in post-emancipation societies. As formerly enslaved people were reimagined as a working force, their capacity to reproduce became a political issue in surprising and fascinating ways. As a really important contribution to our understandings of late 19th and early 20th century British Caribbean history, this book helps us think about public health, social science, gender, motherhood, and many other things. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Juanita, thanks so much for being with me this afternoon.
You're welcome. I'm very happy to have this chance to talk about the book.
So I like to begin by having people tell me a little bit about how they arrived where they are now. So can you tell us how you came to choose history and what brought you to this particular project?
Oh my gosh. I chose history because I love history. I chose history because in the reason that we all chose history as a subject of academic study is just the subject I always found most fascinating, that I always loved the most when I was a student and an undergraduate. And just to understand the past as just always the mystery and the unexpectedness of the past has always really excited me to try and understand that. And since I've been my graduate work certainly as a PhD student, but since I finished my PhD student studies especially, I've been more and more interested in sort of institutional history and the history of sort of colonial institutions and institutions generally. I mean, I work on the Caribbean, and I've been working on the Caribbean since I was a master's student, I guess. I started a project with a professor I was working with at York on the British Virgin Islands during the period of slavery, and found it very interesting. And then when I was thinking about a PhD topic, was pulled towards the Caribbean even more. And because as I told you, we were talking a couple of minutes ago, my half my family is West Indian, Guyanese and Trinidadian, and just grew up hearing stories about Guyana and the Caribbean more generally, and just felt pulled towards wanting to understand that area of the world and that history more. And it just seemed to pull me as a subject for my PhD. This particular book and this particular project, it builds very much on my first project, on my dissertation and my dissertation book, which focused on Guyana, for some of the reasons I mentioned just a minute ago. But it also focused on Georgetown, which is the capital city of Guyana. And I'm a person who I was born in Toronto. I spent much of my life in Toronto, so I'm very much a city person. So I'm fascinated by cities and how they function. And when I was thinking about PhD topics, I was just very interested in the capital city of Guyana and Georgetown. And I wanted to understand how this particular colonial city how it worked, how this very multi-ethnic, multi-racial place functioned on the and the most banal level possible. So how do people interact on the streets and in the marketplaces? I mean, it was those sorts of everyday sort of encounters that I found very interesting. And in the process of doing my research for that particular project, I encountered something that was called the British Guiana Baby Saving League, which is an organization founded in the early 20th century to try to preserve the lives of infants, to help them survive infancy and grow to adulthood. And I mentioned it briefly in the dissertation and in the dissertation book, but it was only after I had finished that project and was thinking about a new research direction that I realized I had a lot of questions about that organization. And it was in the process of trying to make sense of the Baby Saving League in Guyana, and trying to understand how it operated, and trying to understand if there were similar kinds or comparable kinds of organizations elsewhere in the British Caribbean, that all of those questions really provided the genesis for this particular book. I can go on at great length about the Baby Saving League, but we can maybe pause there to see if you have another question.
Well, yeah, I do. I want to talk about the Baby Saving League because I also found that really fascinating, and I actually found some parallels with some of the things that I uncovered in Cuba when I was doing research for my first book. So I really want to talk about that later. But first, I just wanted to ask some sort of broad framing questions.
Sure.
In terms of how you made the decisions about the form and the shape of the book, because I found it very effective and very compelling in a lot of ways. So just to very basically, right, this is a study about post-emancipation society, and post-emancipation studies are growing. There are more and more of them every year, which is wonderful for the field. So I was wondering what made you think about it, apart from the fascinating Baby Saving League. what made you think that the perspective of sex and reproduction and population and the politics of that would be an effective way to sort of investigate this period?
Sure. That's a really good question. That's a really good question. As I was starting to think about this project, so it was the Guyanese Baby Saving League that gave me a way into it. But I very quickly, when I was reading other secondary sources initially, I discovered that there were similar kinds of concerns being expressed in other parts of the world, and specifically other British Caribbean colonies. And the first point of comparison I found was Barbados, which is such an interesting point of comparison because it's a very, very different kind of colony, geographically much smaller, with a very densely populated colony. And in this place, the ideas, sort of the discourse around population and population growth, had some striking similarities to what I saw in Guyana, but also some very important differences. And it was just starting to read the Barbadian material that made me realize, first of all, that I had to take a comparative perspective. So that my first book was just on one colony, and I realized very early on into this project that I didn't want to just write a single colony study. I wanted to do a comparative project. And I wanted to, because I wanted to understand some of the reasons for the differences and the similarities that I was seeing in this region, this single imperial region, but all distinct colonies with their own different forms of government and their own distinct relationships with the metropole, with Great Britain. So the project had to be comparative, and I realized very, very early on as I was reading the sources, sort of, very generally interested in the question of these sort of colonial institutions and sort of questions around history of public health and public health policies in this period, I realized that the sources I was finding, and for the most part, official sources produced in the center of empire, so by imperial officials, but also by colonial physicians, colonial officials as well, were fascinated by the questions, by the intersection of sex and reproduction, that almost everything that I was reading, the kind of sources I was reading, these individuals kept coming back to these issues. And so it was just my attempt to make sense of what I was seeing in the sources that sort of led me in the analytical direction in which I went. And then I was, as I was reading sort of outside the Caribbean, specifically I was reading a lot of U.S. material at this point, African-American material and British imperial material. And I realized that these questions were not just British Caribbean questions, but these were much broader questions. And so this concern about population and population growth and reproduction was something that was expressed in many different places in the late 19th and early 20th century for different kinds of reasons. And that sort of gave me some questions, gave me a bit of a framework to think about what I was finding in the Caribbean.
So you mentioned earlier that you wanted to do a comparative study, which is really interesting and really difficult. Having also tried to do that. So I'm interested in how you chose your places. You talked about Barbados and Guyana, but you also have Jamaica in the mix. And then how did you decide to organize the book? It's organized thematically rather than taking the islands one at a time. And so I'm wondering about the process of that, of that organization.
That was hard. This is my first real comparative project, and boy, it was hard. It was very satisfying, and I'm very happy that I took this approach, but it was a lot more complicated organizationally than I had anticipated. And I, from the beginning, I didn't want to make it colony by colony, because I've read some comparative projects that are sort of organized geographically, and they 10 points in the argument can be a little repetitive. So I wanted to find significant themes, points of difference, points of similarity, and focus on those themes. And so it was so the book was sort of organized around some of these themes that that I identified as significant to all of these places. And I have to admit, the outside reviewers for UNC who published the book and the senior editor, Elaine Mailer, were fantastic. The first version of the book I gave them was good. They were interested in it, but they identified a lot of the problems with how I had organized it because of the comparative approach. And the reviewers and Elaine gave me a lot of really good practical suggestions about making sure that the argument wasn't repetitive and et cetera, et cetera. And that all came down to the challenges of doing this and doing a comparative project. I chose the colonies. I chose Guyana because I know so much about Guyana, I have so much material, and Guyana was a jumping off point for me, Barbados, because it was such a dramatic point of comparison with Guyana, and then Jamaica, because Jamaica is, in the eyes of officials, contemporary officials, British officials especially, and in the eyes of a lot of people today who don't know much about the Anglophone Caribbean, Jamaica really kind of represents the Anglophone Caribbean, and it's of great interest to people who read history, who want to read about the Caribbean, but also in the period that I was talking about, for a lot of colonial officials, and especially at around the time when slavery ends, which is sort of when the book starts, Jamaica and what was happening in Jamaica really seemed to sum up the Caribbean in the eyes of these imperial officials. And so many policies that we see in this period were sort of constructed with Jamaica in mind. And so because it was the biggest island, the most populous island in the British Caribbean, because it was so important in the eyes of imperial officials, Jamaica just seemed like it had to be part of my comparison.
Right. It's often the biggest, it is the biggest island. And so a lot of things end up there or begin there. So one last big question before we get to the chapters. So you talk a lot about colonial officials and their aims, but really a lot of the action is driven by what you call a multi-ethnic group of Caribbean men and women. And so I'm wondering how you came to that choice. And did you think going in that those would be the main actors of this story, of these stories?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. And so, you know, if I had to identify two of the major organizational challenges and sort of analytical challenges I faced in the book. One was the fact that it was an imperative project. The other was to try and find that balance. All along, I don't consider myself an imperial historian. I consider myself a colonial historian, that is a Caribbean historian, someone who stands in the Caribbean and looks out at the world. But because these are colonies, I think we always have to be aware of that imperial context and the actions of officials based in Britain and, in fact, in other places of the empire. And so I needed to find a balance between that. My main interest, actually, this project initially, in part, it came out of my work on doctors, on British Caribbean physicians, mostly Afro and Indo-West Indian physicians. And so they were some of the first Caribbean men whose sources I found. And so a lot of their ideas, their concerns really sort of propelled many of them, the questions that I was exploring in this book. I wanted to think about Caribbean women, the midwives. So I wanted to think about Caribbean people themselves and in all of, because it is a very, very, very diverse region. And I wanted to think about the significance of that ethnic and racial diversity. And I wanted to think about the actions of Caribbean people as kind of driving history. But on the other hand, these are colonies, and policies that were constructed or that emerged in these colonies emerged very much in, not imposed by the imperial center, but out of a series of exchanges with officials in the metropole in Britain itself. So I in organizing the book and in analyzing the sources, I wanted to think about that. And actually my main sort of organizational challenge was the first two chapters of the book really focus on British policies. And I thought that and imperial policies, and I thought that maybe the third chapter should do that as well. But I thought, no, at some point I have to come back to the Caribbean, and I have to really sort of focus on the stories of Caribbean people, on Caribbean people themselves. And so that's why the third chapter was the midwife chapter, because I was feeling increasingly uncomfortable. I was feeling increasingly like it was becoming a bit of an imperial history, and I didn't want that. So I was trying to, just in terms of organizing the chapters, trying to make sure that the structure of the book reflected my desire to emphasize the role of Caribbean people while acknowledging the importance of imperial policies.
Right. So so diving into chapter one, the first thing that comes up and really what frames the whole book is this concern about underpopulation in the immediate post-emancipation period. So the idea is that we need more workers. They're not reproducing quickly enough, or maybe there's high infant mortality. What are we going to do, right? This is from the colonial officials' perspective, of course. Sure. And that was actually really surprising to me, as a lot of the literature on this kind of stuff focuses on later periods and fears of overpopulation, right? I'm thinking of Laura Briggs' work and Nicole Bourbonnais and people like that. So that was really a surprise to me. And I'm wondering if it was as unexpected to you.
I mean, not really. I mean, I read Laura Briggs's book, of course, and Nicole's and part of some of Nicole's earlier work when I was starting to work through my own material. So I was very much aware of what they were talking about in the 20th century, and especially from the 1930s on. But because I was very familiar with, I mean, I work on the post-slavery period, but I was very familiar with the slavery material, some the scholarship. So I was aware that population concerns and these worries about underpopulations and shrinking populations was very important in this early period, until I really started to dive into the until I really started to dig into the primary sources. I wasn't quite as aware how significant it was as a factor in the abolitionist campaigns and how central it was to imperial concerns around the end of slavery itself. And I found that very, very interesting. And in part, I mean, I wanted to, as I said, I'm not a historian of slavery, but as I was trying to think about where these late 19th century concerns about shrinking populations and so on, where that came from, I kept feeling like I had to go back further and further in time, and then finally ended up looking at the abolitionist debates and saw that that's where these concerns were expressed. And so late 19th and early 20th century concerns about the size of populations in the British Caribbean really do have their roots in those late slave era debates and discussions.
That's not something that we hear about very often, so it was very interesting to me.
Okay.
This next question is kind of methodological, right? One of the things I really liked about this book was the way you talk about the emergence of social scientific tools. So the origins of the idea of taxation, the origins of the idea of the census, how to count people. If we're going to make all of these claims, how are we going to count people? How are we going to, you know, make these numbers real? And so I guess my question is, the numbers, it's very clear from the book that the numbers are always political. There's always a kind of agenda there. So how easy, or did you even try to work with the numbers themselves? I mean, did you ever try, or did you get an actual sense of the decline or increases in population, or was that just not your concern? Do you see what I'm saying?
No, I know exactly what you're saying. For me, and I hesitate to say this because I'm sure somebody's going to hit me over the head, but I mean, numbers are discourse, right? Mm-hmm. Numbers serve many ends, and just like language or text, things that we more conventionally think of as discourse, reflect a kind of historical reality. You really have to dig into those sources to try and understand what they're telling you about, what they're telling you about people's ideas and what they tell you about the past. And so my approach to numbers, I take the same approach to numbers. And it was really interesting to me because, you know, there's been a fair amount of scholarship in which historians sometimes from the Caribbean will really sort of quote these numbers very unproblematically, right? They won't and really sort of critique them. And then when you really look at how these numbers were arrived at, well, officials say, well, you know, we haven't done a census in like 50 years. We think there's probably X number of people, but we could be wrong. So given how uncertain the methods of counting populations were in this period, and the fact that, and the inconsistencies among the different colonies, that they had different methods of counting the population, I think it's impossible to arrive at a completely accurate count of the population. I mean, some historians like Barry Higman, for example, his work on Jamaica, and he's worked extensively with the 1844 census, and his work is fantastic, right? So he and a few other historians who are numerically inclined have really digged into those census reports and compared them with other kind of reports, and have come to conclusions that they feel pretty comfortable with about how many people lived in these colonies and probably what the mortality rates were. And so I tended to rely on those historians who've really done an awful lot of that, very complicated work. Because those numbers are important, right? They give you a bit of a basis to argue from. But for me, they're more interesting as reflections of what contemporaries thought. And I'm just so fascinated to see the numbers that contemporaries would note, and then what those numbers actually meant to them. Because those numbers, whether accurate or not, drove policy. And that's a really interesting question. I mean, that's a really interesting subject for me. I said at the beginning, I'm interested in institutions and policies. These policies and institutions were based on these numbers, accurate or inaccurate. That was the basis for them.
Yeah, I thought you did a really nice job of making that point, but then also really suggesting that in the post-emancipation moment, there were issues with infant mortality, and there were issues with health, and there were issues with, you know,
Sure. All
of those kinds of things, right? So
there's reality there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not all, you know, I'm not one of those historians who says it's all discourse. No. You know, people lived and they died and they suffered and they cried and they loved. I mean, we know that. We know a lot about the past. Many things we don't know because of the nature and the incomplete nature of the sources and the problematic nature of the sources, but a lot of stuff we do know. And the sources are pretty clear that there were very high rates of infant mortality, that many, many babies died very, very young. And that was a huge tragedy for men and women and just everyone living in these societies, but also that it was a political issue. Mm-hmm. And so that was also one of the challenges in the book, to think about that, those personal tragedies, as something that drove colonial and imperial policy and institutions. My interest was in the policies and the institutions and the role of Caribbean men and women and British men and women in constructing those. But I never wanted to forget that these were individual tragedies of individual men and women in the past, and to always keep that in my mind, like the personal element of that.
Absolutely. And that comes through. So it actually relates to the thing that I wanted to talk to you about next, which was the coincidence in the book, which is very clear, of the transition to freedom and the revolution in public health, right?
Sure.
In a lot of places you read about the emergence of public health or you read about the transition to freedom, but they haven't really been put together in this way. And I found that really fascinating. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how those are related, because I don't think that you're arguing that they're just kind of a coincidence that they occur together.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. I mean, that coincidence in timing of these events, I think, is absolutely fascinating. And when I knew, of course, that these things were happening at the same time, but until I was really sort of digging into the book, I hadn't really thought about their relationship to each other and how they, in fact, informed each other. And it seemed to me very much that these new scientific ideas, this revolution in health and public health, really shaped a lot of the discourse about the transition to freedom in the British Caribbean, and I would argue in other post-slavery territories, and that these medical ideas really influenced some of the policies that we see, the institutional policies that we see in the post-slavery period. So that this so-called revolution in health, it shaped the transition to freedom. And I don't know. Yeah, it's not something I think that's been really argued quite as that I've seen many other historians argue in the Caribbean. But I think that coincidence and that relationship is absolutely fundamental, that we cannot understand the post-slavery moment, that we cannot understand the transition to freedom without thinking about these new medical ideas, and these new ideas about health and disease and the causation of disease, and what that all had to do with this concern in the British Caribbean and by imperial officials about the size of populations and shrinking populations in this part of the world. And then in turn, what that meant for the economic survival of these areas. And that was, something, I'm not an economic historian, but at some point when I was working on the book, I realized I have to think about the colonial economy, because these questions about health and the disease and the causes of disease and shrinking populations, they're political questions, but they're also economic questions. And so I found myself digging into all sorts of economic history scholarship, much to my surprise.
We all get there eventually.
Yeah, I think we have to.
So the presence of middle class reformers, Caribbean people in this context was really quite important. It seems. And so I'm wondering the extent to which they were driving this and the ways that their stakes were different from those of colonial officials.
Sure. That's really important. And as I was in the first years, gosh, because it was a while I was working on the book, but the first little while I was working on it, I was teaching a graduate course at McMaster on gender in the African diaspora, and we were reading a lot of the U.S. literature, especially Glenda Elizabeth Gilmore's book, and her book was so inspirational and so influential for me. I was so fascinated about the material that she found about African-American female philanthropists and male philanthropists, their activities with poor, less fortunate members of the African-American community. And I was just in the political nature of their philanthropy. And I was very interested in what she was able to discover in the context of the U.S. And so as I was reading the Caribbean material, thinking very much about some of her discoveries and seeing, can I find things like that for the Caribbean? And to my delight, I mean, sources are very, very different for the Caribbean than they are than they are for the U.S., of course. But I was really pleased at some of the material that I was able to find, that it very, you know, nicely shows the role of Caribbean men and women, black and colored and white, and their role as philanthropists. I mean, there have been a number of really good Caribbean historians who've done a lot of the background work on this, identified these organizations. And what I was trying to do was to try to look at these organizations in a different way, to think about them as sort of the precursors to the baby saving leagues, and think about the baby saving leagues themselves and these sort of early 20th century iterations of these philanthropic organizations.
Yeah. So let's talk about midwives.
Okay.
In most settings, it seems like there's this conflict between the midwives, or the grannies, you call them. I love that term.
Yeah.
And the kind of official medical establishment. Mm-hmm. And the same conflict occurs here, but you argue that the efforts to train midwives and to kind of officialize them really doesn't work. It's undermined by physicians, by mothers, and by midwives themselves. And so I'm wondering if you're pointing to the limits of the colonial state, as this is sort of the limits that it could arrive to, and its projects were just not successful.
Yes and no, actually. I mean, this is one of my favorite chapters, and it was one of the first ones that I really worked up and wrote. It was the first one that really took shape, and I found it so interesting to work on for a number of reasons. First of all, because I saw so many similarities with between the British Caribbean and other parts of the British Empire, and actually with the U.S. context. So these conflicts between physicians and traditional midwives, and the negative representations of traditional midwives as causing infant deaths, as unclean, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what was fascinating to me is how pervasive these kinds of these representations are. I mean, you see them in most places, so that was really interesting to me. But something else, and of course, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, this chapter does show the limits of imperial policies and attempts to eradicate the midwives. It shows that for very pragmatic reasons, cost, accessibility, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the most fascinating things I found when I was working on this chapter was my discovery of the efforts of imperial and colonial officials to try to incorporate the grannies into the world of colonial medicine and into sort of official midwifery, and which was sort of, and not sort of, but represented, I thought, an admission of defeat by these officials, that they're essentially saying these traditional midwives aren't going to go away. Local women, poor women, are still going to use them for all kinds of pragmatic and cultural reasons. We have to work with them, right? So in a way, I found that so interesting, sort of a victory by the midwives over, you know, imperial officialdom, and a recognition by these officials that we can't defeat these women. And so we have to find a way to recognize their skills and bring them into the system. And that was one of the more unexpected findings in when I was researching this chapter. And I think, and one thing that I was trying to do in this chapter was to show the different tensions at play and all of the different rivalries and the different pressures. And so rivalries and conflict between physicians and formerly trained midwives and with the grannies, and to try and show also the role of poor non-white women themselves, who for a whole range of reasons still use the granny midwives, but use formerly trained midwives as well, and to try and emphasize the complexity of, to try and emphasize the myriad factors that limited the choices of poor women, because sometimes some of those some scholars who talk about midwifery and the history of midwifery, I don't know so much anymore, but used to kind of come at it from maybe a more politicized perspective, that, you know, granny midwives, traditional midwives are, I don't know, the better choice for women, closer to the concerns of poor women, right? And what I was trying to do in this chapter was to think about the various factors that shaped women's abilities to choose and the kinds of decisions that poor women made. So could they get to a hospital? Could they afford a traditionally trained midwife? If they could, did they want to use her? Was she too culturally distant from her? And to try to think about all of the various factors that were relevant in the decision-making process of poor women.
Yeah, it's a really complicated, when you describe it that way, it's a really complex set of issues. And it also, I think it sort of highlights the hybridity of these kinds of systems, right? Where there's sure. not one choice or two choices, but many different kinds of dimensions and aspects to them, and people kind of accommodating and changing according to sort of what's out there and what the yeah. constraints are.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wanted to do, to try to relay that complexity, to show that there wasn't just one reason why people behaved in the way that they did, but there are multiple reasons, and to try to follow each one of those and to try and understand some of the reasons behind them. That was a fascinating chapter to work on, and that was actually one chapter in particular that I presented at a number of conferences, and I presented some of it at a sort of a Skype conference in the UK a couple of years ago. And it was some comments by David Arnold about traditional midwives, what their role was, that really prompted me to think about some of these questions in a very, very serious way. And so much of what I finally concluded about midwives owes a great deal to his comments and to some of the other participants in that conference a few years ago. So that's one chapter where I can point to some of the conclusions that I draw, and I can say, yeah, I remember X talked to me about so-and-so and really helped me think through that material. So that was a nice chapter for me to remember, because I can remember all the decisions that I made and why I made them and how I thought about this stuff.
It is really interesting to actually talk to somebody about this this kind of thing and to think about work as a kind of collective effort, right? And
yeah.
You do. You have these moments in the writing that you do where you think, oh, yeah, that's because so-and-so asked me a question or so-and-so sent me a source and it changed everything, right?
Yeah. No, and it's wonderful. And it's nice to, and I was actually just rereading the book today, so because it's been a while that I've looked at it, and in preparation for this, I was rereading it. And sort of skimming through it a bit and finding places, oh, I remember when I wrote that. I remember what I was thinking about, and so-and-so mentioned X to me, and it was, it's just nice to remember the origins of our thought process and where those conclusions come from. And to remember we work by ourselves as historians for the most part, but, you know, but we always build on the work of others, right? What we read and who we talk to. So it's nice to acknowledge that.
Right. And when what you're doing sort of sparks a kind of reaction, that's also very satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely.
So baby saving leagues.
Okay.
maybe you can just talk a little bit about them for people who haven't read the book and who don't know what a baby saving league is.
Okay. So that was, as I said at the beginning, I mean, that was trying to understand the Guyanese baby saving league really was the genesis of the book. And baby saving leagues are these organizations that we see in many places in Canada, the United States, in the UK, in the Caribbean, other colonies. And you mentioned in Cuba, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So places in Latin America as well. But we see in the early 20th century organizations for the most part, led by or organized by men and women, often mostly women, middle class or elite women who are interested in philanthropy and who organize these leagues or these groups to try to teach poor women the best way, so the most modern way in contemporary terms, how to rear their children so that more children could survive. And so these were a response to late 19th and early 20th century concerns about shrinking populations, which were not just expressed in the British Caribbean, but we see these concerns expressed in many places globally in the early 20th century. And these organizations were one response to this problem, very much sort of elite / middle class led philanthropic organizations. But they're also in many places supported by the state. And so that's the case in some places in the British Caribbean, because the state governments, colonial governments and governments elsewhere recognized an interest in these organizations because they believe that they would have a positive effect.
So in the Cuban case, I guess what I found was were these baby contests, which you also mentioned.
Yeah.
Beautiful baby contests.
Yeah.
And they had this kind of eugenic cast, right? The kind of soft eugenics that Nancy Stepan talks about, environmental eugenics. The idea that you can, you know, improve a race by improving its environment, its surroundings. And so I was wondering if the eugenics arguments come into those at all.
Sure. I mean, when you see, because I read Nancy Stephan's work, and some of the other Latin American work and the Cuban work. And so I was looking for eugenics. I was looking for eugenics in the British Caribbean. And I didn't find the kind of explicit discussions of the sort of, I guess, hard eugenics that you see in some places in this period, but very much these sort of concerns that you see in Britain in this period, which is a different kind of eugenicist language about the survival of the race, the survival of the population, and what should be done to facilitate facilitate infant survival and growth, and therefore the survival and flourishing of the race. And so the kinds of policies that were put in place that were advocated by these baby saving leagues, but also by government officials, public health doctors, and state employed midwives, and so on, to encourage to make the environment in which an infant was reared as hygienic as possible, to fix the physical environment, to and try to encourage more parents to marry, to improve the sort of the moral environment, I guess, out of the idea, based on the idea that that would see more children, more infants survive. Just try to teach or show poor women the best ways to feed their infants and so on and so on. So various kinds of social, moral, nutritional policies advocated by these philanthropic groups, but also by the state as well, all with the same goal: to ensure the survival of infants and therefore the survival of the race. And so very much, so these very much had, were informed by eugenicist concerns of the time. And you see the sort of the soft eugenicist language, but with very few except, I have a couple of examples, but just a handful of examples I found in which I saw colonial officials and some physicians talking in sort of the harder eugenic terms about the merits of allowing sickly infants to die as being is to help to for the betterment of society. I mean, I saw and I discussed some of those examples in the book, but and they are distressing to read. And but what is striking is, in comparison to other places that I sort of other territories in this period, that I didn't see that many examples of those. They were there and they were important and, as I say, distressing to read, but they are outnumbered by a different kind of discourse.
So very much the on the soft eugenics side of things.
Yeah. No, for sure.
So by the end of the book, there is a transformation, right? So suddenly there are more worries about overpopulation than underpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering how you account for this transformation.
I mean, that's another place where my use of numbers plays into my analysis. So what seems that is happening by the mid 1920s and late 20s, and certainly by the 30s, populations really were increasing. Death rates were falling. And so most historians, all historians who work on this period in the British Caribbean acknowledge this. Contemporaries acknowledge this. But as I say this, I feel I also have to say that most places in the British Caribbean, like they had their, you know, by the mid 1930s, their last census was like in 1921, right? Mm. So they had gone like 10 or no longer than that, my gosh, like 1911 in some cases. So they had gone like quite a long time without an official population count. And so historians and social scientists, sort of the first generation of social scientists working in the 30s and especially in the 40s, argue that we do see population starting to increase in this period because mortality rates really were falling and birth rates were going up. And so they're pretty certain about that. But then I just, as someone who reads census reports with a sort of a jaundiced eye, I feel like I have to say, yes, but you know, there really hasn't been a census for 20 years. And so a lot of the evidence for this is anecdotal, right? But I think, you know, with pushing aside all of those caveats in my kind of, you know, irritating like historian kind of way, we can push those aside and say, yes, population was growing because death rates, mortality rates were falling. And there's been, you know, some scholarship that looks at some of the reasons for that. I mean, James Riley argues that in his really interesting work on Jamaica in the 20th century, I mean, he argues that the public health education campaigns really were paying off. I mean, there's different interpretations for this. But yes, I mean, by the 1930s, it's this really dramatic and I just think really dramatic change in emphasis from this early 20th century focus on shrinking populations and the decline of the population to the 1930s and the Moyne Commission, which is this British inquiry into the causes of protests in the mid-1930s that happened throughout the British Caribbean. And so and it's called the Moyne Commission. It's the West India Royal Commission, but the shorthand version for Caribbeanists is the Moyne Commission because it's named after, we call it after Lord Moyne, who was the head of the inquiry. And the Moyne Commission, the Moyne Commission officials were obsessed by what they saw as overpopulation in the Caribbean, the fact that the population was growing madly out of control and that was going to lead to all kinds of social and political calamities. And so for me to read the Moyne Commission report and the testimony and the commissioner's conclusions, reading it while I was still thinking about the discussions from the 1910s and the early 20th century about underpopulation and shrinking populations, was the contrast was so stark. It was just really stark. But what was so fascinating was the similarities in the in these official representations of poor West Indians as they're represented, their sexual behavior and their family forms were still represented as part of the problem and the cause of overpopulation, just that as it had been seen as the cause of shrinking populations in the early 20th century. So it was fascinating for me to see the differences between the 1930s and the early 20th century, but also to see some of the similarities, the discursive similarities.
Right. It's fascinating that the same causes suddenly lead to do really, really, really different outcomes, right?
Yeah. No, it was great. I mean, the West India Royal Commission is this fascinating document. And historians of the Anglophone Caribbean who had worked on this report, it was produced as an attempt to make sense of labor protests and political protests. A lot of historians have sort of looked at it as a political document and what it told us about labor relations and politics in this period. But increasingly, social historians like me and like Laura Putnam and Nicole Bourbonnais are using this report to try to understand social attitudes and cultural attitudes of this period. And this document is just rich with that kind of material.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm wondering, even in the transformation, even in the shift from sort of underpopulation to overpopulation, did some of those programs and institutions that were put in place, did they remain? Was there a kind of legacy of all of these years of efforts to increase the population?
Yes, there were. And so that's also one of the interesting developments, or one of the interesting consequences of the early period that I look at the book. So the baby saving leagues become and infant welfare clinics and maternal education campaigns that were developed in the early 20th century in this kind of piecemeal fashion, organized and staffed by local philanthropists with some involvement of the state. By the late 20s and certainly by the early 1930s, they become fairly, ubiquitous is too strong, but they become much more extensive. And they really do provide a basis for, I think, the social welfare programs that you see after the war, I mean, in the 1940s. And so they really are built on these early 20th century organizations.
It's really fascinating to see those continuities.
Yeah, no, I think so, absolutely. And that's, I mean, so the book ends, I mean, I end with the West India Royal Commission and the riots and the Moyne Commission of the 1930s. But I think, I mean, and Nicole Bourbonnais' book, which should be out, I don't know, within the next year, I mean, she talks about population control policies sort of in the 1930s, but especially the 1940s and after. And that period sort of after the Second World War, that's when you see a much more extensive emergence of these social welfare institutions built on these early 20th century institutions that I talk about in the book, but they grow quite significantly after the war. And I think that would be That could be the next book. I don't know. But I think that would be something really interesting to look at.
Absolutely. So we've taken up a lot of your time. I have one last question for you.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if there's any implications of all of these kinds of debates and all of these sorts of conflicts and issues in the Caribbean today. Are any of these debates being revisited or repeated? Do you see anything, any of the lasting legacies?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. Some of the debates that I see as continuing to be relevant, not only in the Caribbean, but in other places, in this sort of easy tendency by politicians to castigate poor people for using state-provided medical resources and to try to limit poor people's access to medical resources. And I mean, those were concerns that were expressed in the 19th century in the Caribbean in the immediate post-emancipation period, continued to be expressed in the early 20th century, but are still expressed today. I mean, you hear it in Canada, you hear it in other countries, you hear it in the Caribbean, in which poor people are condemned for being lazy, for not working. Their poverty is seen as their fault, and they're condemned for taking advantage of state resources in a way that's so unjust and that doesn't acknowledge the consequences of poverty. That's one of the things. That's one of the elements that I see as continuing to resonate today.
Yeah, I think the book really helps to contextualize a lot of those debates and discourses.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks a lot for talking to me today.
Oh, you're welcome. I really enjoyed it as well. It's always fun to talk about the book. So thank you very much for your interest and the great questions.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and I hope you can join me next time.